and it went like.
Hi everybody, this is Betty Toledo. We are here with Buzz Games Grindset, and today we're going to be talking about the master's degree. You guys already talk about the graduation, everything that you need to be a game developer, at least to start. There is much more to it than just coming and learning how to be a producer or a designer or programmer or visual artist. So today we have Thomas. Thomas, I am famous for butchering surnames, so I'm not going to do that. You can say yours. But Thomas, please introduce yourself.
All right. Thank you so much. Wonderful to be here. My name is Thomas Buitenweg, and I recognize that as an incredibly difficult last name.
For a non-Dutch, it's impossible.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, my name is Thomas Buitenweg. I work at Breda University of Applied Sciences as a lecturer in a master's program, Master Game Technology, where we teach R&D, so research and development, and try to push bachelor students that have gone through our program and also externals to the next level of learning how to deal with complex data to push the games industry further, to really deep dive into the most complex problems that are within the games industry, both on a technical level, so developing the next tool sets that are relevant for proper game development, but also on a more design focused level of like, how do we push the industry forward from a business point of view? How do we push the industry further when it comes to large ethical problems, specifically also AI that's now rapidly developing? And how do we tackle these new technological challenges whilst making sure that our industry continues to thrive? And especially in the current situation where we see a lot of layoffs happening, that's also where we see a massive influx of students and professionals coming back to school to upskill. And that's really interesting right now in terms of developing this program further and further. It's been around now for over 10 years, and it's in the best version we've ever had. And now that we are like slowly growing the program, it's becoming the most interesting program that I've ever seen on the master's level.
Oh, that's great. And also, it's really interesting that master degree in a university of applied science is deeply different from master degree in a traditional university. For the ones that don't know much about that, how would you explain the difference?
Ah, right. Yes, that's a very common question I get, especially during open days and the like, is a lot of people have this preconceived notion of what a master's is like. And then especially when we're talking academia, they're really focused on the traditional research skills and the like. And again, like you mentioned, we're not that type of university. We're in applied sciences, so we really focus on building practical examples and proof of concepts of the new innovative tech that's out there. So it's not so much about doing desk research for the entire program. No, it's about building something practical to demonstrate that that is the way forward or not. And that's the beauty of this kind of research and that freedom that you have in this kind of program. It's not about getting the best result and that it always has to succeed. It's about experimentation with new technology to see, is this worth investing in? Is this worth going forward with? To create that profile of experienced professional that can be that bridge between a data science team and a game development team. What we've noticed in collaboration with our industry partners like Aurelia and the like is the professionals that work in game development directly typically don't have a statistics background or a qualitative research background. But then having a data scientist typically doesn't have the game development experience. And there's a lot of disconnect between these two types of professions. But what we're seeing in a lot of large studios is that they're getting more and more of these situations where they have a lot of data and they have some scientists looking at that data, but then they struggle to translate that data and those insights into meaningful game design decisions or new tech innovation in a productive way that is measurable and effective. And that's exactly the kind of person that we're trying to train. That is that bridge between the hardcore data science and the really cool development that sometimes has a little bit still that bedroom programmer kind of attitude of we'll just see and hope that it works. We're trying to create a more mature industry in that sense of people that are truly knowledgeable about what they're doing, but they also can demonstrate early on in the process of like, is this worth actually investing millions in? Or should we maybe not push this angle? We've thoroughly tested the concept that we have on paper. We have developed an early prototype And we now have the data to say, okay, we're going to spend the next 6 years on this technology or not. And that's what we're seeing with a lot of our industry partners, is like, you can't make these kind of mistakes anymore. And we've seen it in a lot of games over the last few years, where we've seen quite a few really big titles have major issues on release. And I think that's part of the problem, is that there's not enough critical data-driven choice-making happening in the early stages. Companies committing to relatively risky developments without thoroughly testing it beforehand, and then 6 years later, close to launch, they realize, oh, it doesn't actually work as well as we had hoped, and then start wasting a lot of money.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because the companies, we see a lot of data-driven companies in mobile spectrum, but not that much in AAA. Mm-hmm. But it's very interesting to see that we haven't learned from the mobile. Supercell is a great example of that, of a company that it built the successes on data. And they have been testing and analyzing data from games and prototypes for years, and they are still doing. Now they, with AI and everything, they always try to be in the forefront. And I always find interesting that the AAA companies somehow don't learn all the time from them. It's changing, which is great, but it's not always. Big ships are not as easy to steer.
No, and they do a lot on the business side, right? Like, there's a lot of business analytics running in terms of sales, in terms of marketing. But when we're looking at the truly creative tool sets, yes, there are all kinds of new applications being developed, but they take months, years sometimes even to roll into a development pipeline. And that makes sense, right? Like, that's a change management exercise first and foremost. And that's also why in this master's we focus a lot on the people management and change management as well. Because you can build the coolest tool set ever, but if you can't convince a development team to actually start adopting this new tool set, you might as well not make it. Right? Like, and people like the comfort of the previous tools they've always used. So it's not an easy challenge. And we see this every year, right? Like, there's always a student that proposes a new level generator. And then the first thing we tell them is, start talking to level designers, because you don't know their profession well enough to just start building a tool out of nowhere. You need to first thoroughly understand their pipeline. You need to understand what kind of data they're collecting, if they're even collecting any data in the first place, because in practice, I noticed they don't. So there are a lot of questions you need to start asking before you even start developing something like this. And that's also why we really listen to our industry partners and like, okay, what do these people truly need to be able to do? And a large part of that is also people skills. It's not just sit behind the desk, do the research, build a tool, and we're done. There's so much more that comes to proper change management and proper implementation of new technology that a lot of companies struggle with and a lot of people lack the insight into. And that's what we're trying to provide. And it's looking quite positive. Like, every year we have the industry showcase that we host at BUAS. We present all the master work as well. And it's a little less flashy than what some of the bachelor students will be producing, because they spend a lot of time on making excellent character models. But the research, it's always a little bit more bland to present. But if we're talking about impact, if we're talking about what is actually changing how we work, that type of research is essential.
Yeah, and for the ones that don't know, we have an industry showcase every end of the year. Neville talked about that when we were here, but it's a really big event for us, because it's not only about showcasing what we're doing, but it's also, as Thomas was saying, it's connecting with the industry, and it's almost like a checkpoint. But besides what we do every day of, are we on the right track? Do we need to change anything? What is the temperature of the water outside in the world? And I think you also mentioned that one of the biggest advantages that we have here is how close we are to the industry. Because I think a lot of the research is done worldwide. They are super interesting, but sometimes, like, I read a lot of researches, and sometimes I see, this is great. Why wasn't it connected with the products that is out that are out there, instead of just being, you read this immense bibliography and then wrote a research about it?
Yeah, and it's also a very common problem, right? The games industry is just hyper-competitive. There are a lot of big players that all are fighting for the same audiences. So any research they do internally, they tend to not share. And that makes a lot of sense from a competitive point of view, but from a pure research perspective, this is obviously a major problem. I recall when I did my master's quite a few years back, that my supervisor used to work at Ubisoft, and he was telling me already during the research, it's like, I know your answer to your research question, I'm just not allowed to tell you. I have an NDA that prevents me from telling you what the answer is.
That sucks.
Yeah. So I was doing research that I just knew was going in the right direction. And therefore, it was still valuable because it was covered under several NDAs. So I was making basically a public version of what was already done, but now public for all industry to take note of. And that's a thing that we really need to start addressing in the games industry in general, is like sharing the resources, sharing the data. Especially in the context of the rapid development cycles that we're working with, is I know that a lot of companies want to protect their data. That makes a lot of sense. However, if you publish it now and you've already been developing it for 2 years, it's already largely out of date for your competitors to actually use. So that high level of secrecy about new innovation is actually not that critical. And I find that that is a thing that's holding back a lot of industry, where we're reinventing the wheel so many times. And I think that's a real shame. I think we can accelerate the games industry tremendously if we would collaborate more between these studios.
We could have another podcast only talking about the state of the games industry. But before we go on that, because if our time allows, I actually wanted to tap on that too. But before we go there, when I think people, you mentioned that people have a misconception about masters. And I think this is general. People think academics are blunt, dry people that have no experience with the industry. They have no idea what they're doing. They're just sitting and reading books. How should the people that come to Buzz to do the master, they come, what is the procedure for them to get in, and what should they expect? Because also it's a year. There is a lot of normal universities. Like, I have no idea what it's going in the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. Scientific university is usually 2 years at least, sometimes longer. But yeah, Here is only 1 year. So what should they expect from that year?
Yeah, what we do is internally we refer to it as an in-depth master's. Like, a lot of masters have this structure where they take anyone in that has a bachelor degree, regardless of what kind of subject you previously studied. We only take people that have already done game development to some extent, and we take a deep dive. And that's also why it's only 1 year, and we're really focusing on the practical side, because we assume you have done the basics of game development already. And that you, for example, if you're proposing something like, I want to do real-time ray tracing in new technology with new graphics cards and the like, we're assuming you have done some ray tracing work in the past already, and that you're truly going to be pushing the boundary of what that technology is able to do as your project. So that's during the intake, we ask, what area of expertise are you trying to specialize in, so that we can make sure that we have a supervisor that fits that topic really well. And that also we can check, do you have the foundational skills already to be able to actually dive deep into that? Otherwise, we end up just teaching you the bachelor content, and that's defeating the point. So that's why we are able to take in people that have done a full bachelor's program, or people that have done industry already and then want to specialize further. These type of groups then merge into this program really well. So that starts with that proposal. And then afterwards, we do an interview just to double check, are you in the right place? Is this the right program for you? And then we start instantly, day one, with what is your research question? What kind of literature do you need? And what does the industry already know? Just to make sure that what you're doing actually is new. Because there's a lot out there already. And it, especially in the games industry, which is poorly documented, it typically is hard to find. However, once that foundation is there, we start doing the practical. That's where we instantly start. Let's start building a prototype. Let's start testing this. Let's start collecting data. Let's find participants to test this with, so that you have a really practical end result that you can just show, here's a piece of software that demonstrates the concept that I was proposing. Nothing paper-based. Yes, there is a thesis involved, but that only exists to support the practical thing that you're developing.
Nice. So they have to come. I have to ask, how does someone know that something is good for a master degree or something is something that it's a product development in this case. Like I have an idea, I have a question, how do they really discern that? And it might sound like a ridiculous question, but the master is not really clear for a lot of people.
Yeah, I get that that question quite often. And it's a good question because there are three things you can ask yourself regarding this. And that's typically what I propose to most people that are interested in masters in general. Is the problem that you're proposing to solve are three criteria that are relevant here. Is there a industry need for the thing that you're proposing? Is there a societal need for what you're proposing? And is there an academic unclarity about the topic?
I think that's the bit, because the first and the second can easily be applied for a product development as well. But the academic question is the one that makes the huge difference, right?
Yes, exactly, because that is the one that clearly details we don't know the answer yet, right? The other two are important for societal reasons. We want to push society further in some meaningful way. So consider how can this technology be applied broader than just games? Because a lot of tech goes way beyond just the games industry nowadays. The industry benefit is important because you would like to have a job after this. So make sure that you build something that is relevant for industry that they can ideally use the moment you graduate. We would like to get you a job at the end of this. And that last one, the academic one, that's also the one that people struggle with the most because they typically don't have a background in academia. Most bachelor programs nowadays do a lot less on the traditional academic side, which I'm actually a big fan of. Put that in masters, don't do that in bachelors as much. But to check for that, there's a very simple solution to this. There is scholar.google.com.
Yep.
Type in your topic. You will find if there are papers on this. And you don't have to read the entire paper to check. Read the abstract. You'll get a glimpse of what is in that paper. You will instantly see, oh, the topic I'm proposing, other people have worked on this, almost always. Make sure that what is in those papers matches to some degree what you're interested in, but doesn't completely answer your thing.
Yeah, that's the other thing, is that there is a saying in creative industry that nothing is completely new anymore. Everything is a revamp of something else, because how many songs have been made? How many films have been made? And in technology, there is a lot of innovation, but I think also the innovation is answering problems that the technology that is there didn't answer yet. So it's not, I will create a new planet and do it's really understanding what was researched, what is there, and then finding the holes, because there are always holes.
Yes,
right?
Definitely. And what a lot of people also underestimate is the importance of improving things.
Yep.
Right, a lot of research exists that has demonstrated the concept in its very earliest form. What we typically talk about is the TRL chain, the technology readiness level. And a lot of foundational initial research is level 1, 2, 3. That's where we talk hyper-theoretical, is it even possible kind of topic.
Yep.
That's not what you do in a master's. That's a PhD and then some. Level 4, 5, 6, that's where we're starting to move from theory to practical implementation. That's where a lot of master's research happens. And then you have the last few levels where it moves from initial research project to commercial application. And that's that last bit is what most people end up doing as a master's topic, where it's taking some new existing technology that has been somewhat tested, not optimized, not built into a proper tool or pipeline, and taking that early stage of technology, for example, AI tools right now, and turning them into practical, usable tools for large development teams. Like what you see right now with all the image generation, for example. They're all automated platforms with very limited control. That will never actually work for game development. You need far more finesse and control to be able to implement image generation into an actual game development pipeline.
Yep.
That means that the technology isn't properly rolled out yet. There is an ideal master's project right there. Like, how do I present image generation in a productive pipeline for game development purposes, be that in concept or whatever stage you want to use the image generation in. However, that also begs a lot of interesting questions instantly of like, okay, do we actually want to roll out this development? And that's a key thing that we also focus on in the program, is the ethical decision-making part. Right? The games industry has a lot of strange choices being made at times, and we need to educate people to do better, to make proper, sound, ethical choices about the furthering the technology, making sure that they at least are aware of the choice that they're making, that there are consequences to certain actions, and that they are mindful of those choices.
I have so many questions on so many things, but I want to ask one before I go, because now I have questions about the AI. I have questions, but I wanted to ask first, is there one research topic that we have worked here? I don't know. It might be that you turn to me and say, nope, I cannot disclose that. But is there one research topic that we work here in this 10 years mm-hmm. that particularly stood out for you? That it could be a good example for people to understand what are the research that we do here?
Yeah, we had a very interesting project that ended up not being published for non-disclosure reasons. But if it comes down to the importance of diversity from a personality profile point of view in your development teams.
Nice.
So what that research entailed was investigating, does a team with a very diverse personality profile in the members of their team outperform or underperform compared to a team with very similar personality profiles? And the interesting study there was that we observed teams in Game Lab for several months to see how they communicate, what kind of concepts they create, how creative are these concepts, but also how fluid is their development process and how efficient are they in their development process. And it's a little bit predictable, but it's nice to have the data behind it, is that teams with very diverse personality profiles are far more creative. So regardless of your political views on diversity and the like, there is just data that having a diverse personality profile in your team is beneficial to your development in the creative stages. However, what it also revealed is that in very regular, streamlined development processes, you don't want very different personality profiles.
Okay, so one of the things I say, first, it's interesting they're saying personality diverse. I think people talk up, there has been quite a lot of talk in the games industry about diversity in teams. Mm-hmm. But when they are talking diversity, they are thinking gender, race, culture. They mm-hmm. are not talking about personalities. The fact that the research was focused on personalities is already interesting. But mm-hmm. how can you have a research saying that it's better to be diverse, but then it's not better to be diverse? It's like,
It clearly depended on the stage of development. In the early concepting phase, where creativity can go many directions and where you don't want to narrow down your choice making too early, that's where we noticed that they were able to create far more effectively a range of interesting concepts that then made them pick the best one very effectively through heated debate, because those personalities clash, obviously.
Fight.
Yes, but then when it came to the production pipeline, where choices have been made and now we just need to sit down and work, where you don't want those kind of personality clashes anymore, is where we started noting that they were actually slower in terms of development because they were constantly discussing topics that they had previously decided on. That might be that they don't have enough of an experienced producer on their team. That might also be rooted in that maybe we should reevaluate concepts more often during production. That's unclear, right? Like, this is purely measuring the personality profiles. There are many reasons why productivity can slow down.
And I have to go to the AI for full disclosure for the people to do. Thomas is deeply related with AI inside of the academy. Our academy is games, of course, and because, well, we are CMGT, but also we are AI and creative business. We're not only games, and we work very closely with AI, and it's the elephant in the room. It's as big as the main room, that is the fear of game developers with working with AI or how AI would do. And then you were talking about image generated. And I know a lot of studios are already working with AI. So first of all, for the people that are coming and want to research or want to study, it doesn't matter if it is in the bachelor or in the master, what is your opinion that they should, what is the mindset that they should get in relation to AI?
It's a very complex topic. And the short answer would be, you need to learn about something that is coming for you, regardless of your opinion of it.
Yeah, I agree with you. Like the freight train is coming in your direction.
You can either stand there and let it hit you, or you can learn about what's coming at you so that you can take proper action. And we've seen these type of developments in the past. We've seen this with photography, where digital cameras came in. All the traditional artists suddenly had a major problem. We've seen a very similar pattern happening. And what you'll likely see in the coming years is that we'll get this hybrid artist that can work both with AI tools to speed up their process, but a large amount of creativity is still going to come from the initial artist. That is unpredictable how quickly that will go, but one thing's for sure, that's technology is not going away.
Nope. Yeah, and I find it, no disclosure, I'm not going to throw anybody under the bus, but I know of really, really, really big AAA studios working with really, really, really big IPs that are already using AI. They are behind closed doors with no camera recording because of NDAs in giving classes saying that they are using AI for concept choosing because they learned how to do the best prompts, and then they can test different concepts before they spent any time designing or doing anything, and also for background. So they worked, this specific art director was saying that they have really big areas. It's an open world. There's a lot of area. So they would create those areas on AI and then paint on top of it, change, make it unique, make it. Mm-hmm. But what he did with their process is that things that would take a week to get ready, it takes half a day now.
Yeah. And there are two very important things to note there, right? Because we've, like those large landscape generations, we used to do that through proceduralism.
Yep.
Now we're doing it with AI. It's also a procedural system.
Yep.
The difference is that AI has a bad reputation due to a different reason. The technology itself is not the problem. How they obtain their data is the problem. That's where IP theft happened. That's where people definitely were stolen from. And that's a problem. I fully agree with that. I will defend any artist where their intellectual property has been taken into an AI system. I think they are fully correct that that is incorrect, that that should not have happened.
But is it the technology's problem? It's the company's issue, right? Like you create a is very bad comparison, but bear with me. There is this talk, it's about guns and people. I am completely against guns, for the record, completely against. But the truth is, the mental health and the people behind it are the problem. The gun, not necessarily the guns.
You could take it two ways, right? Like you could also remove all the guns and then you don't have that problem anymore.
True, but you would still have knives. So that being said, the point I say, again, completely against guns, not that point. But the point I'm trying to make is the technology, any technology can be used for good or for bad. Mm-hmm. Those are the companies behind it and the people using the technology as well, right?
Yeah, for sure. Like there are some initiatives coming up, like the European AI Act, which is far ahead of most other parts of the world. But that's also already highlighting a problem. Like, yes, the AI Act is trying to reduce the amount of things that you can do with AI and make sure that your data is protected and these kind of things. That's a very European stance on how to deal with data. The problem is, if not everyone does this, we still have an issue, but because then these companies will just move outside of the EU and do their business there. So that's not per se a solution to this entire IP theft problem. What I would propose is something similar to Buma Stemra, how they deal with it in the music industry, where every piece of music is just registered. And if you want to use it for a radio show or a podcast, you can license that music to be used within that production. That might be a better solution when we talk about digital art as well.
But then It's a hard question because, hey, is this still, my question was like, is this the company behind, or is it only because it's such a new technology? Bear in mind, AI has been around forever. It's new on the way that is being used now. It's new on being open for everybody to use for everything. Is it because it's new and open to everybody and everything that the company didn't foresee? Or what do you I don't want to throw companies under the bus either. So, but being politically correct in this case is really hard.
It's because it's a nuanced discussion. And I've had this discussion with my students as well. And I don't think there's a clean answer. What I can say, however, is that, yes, a large amount of data were taken from people without consent.
It's a problem that needs to be solved.
That's a problem that needs to be solved. That is clearly, on a moral level, just not okay. The law isn't there to properly deal with this at the moment, but that's always the case when it comes to technology innovation. That's why ethical decision-making is so important. You don't want to be the person in history that initially said, oh, this is fine, and then 10 years later turns out to be the problem.
Yep.
Laws will catch up to the reality of the situation. However, there is also a massive benefit to these technologies being developed, and you don't want to stifle potentially really powerful technology due to a small amount of people suffering the consequences. Now, however, the problem here is that it's not a small amount of people that are suffering the consequences. There are a lot of artists that are potentially missing out on work and the like, and that's not just visual artists, right? This applies to voice actors. There are so many creative industries.
Script writers and...
Exactly. There are so many different people being affected by this, is that you cannot say it's a small amount of people that are suffering the downsides of this technology. And there is also not a singular organization or person that can say what is right or wrong here. That makes this an incredibly difficult conversation to have nuance in. Because yes, there are people hurting here. And as long as we don't make choices around this, they will continue hurting whilst the technology steamrolls over their livelihoods.
I will turn it back to the master again, because we are having two podcasts in one, and we need to have a separate one just to talk about AI, because you guys notice this is a really, really big... I wanted to make a comment, because I like being the last one that said something. No, the comment I would say is, we had this problem. We still have this problem with the internet. We still have this problem with social media. Bear in mind what Thomas is saying, that it's something that will need to be solved. Yes, it's true. It needs to be solved. But we have had these problems in other aspects. There are still not full regulation against online bullying. There are a lot of things that technology brings that are really good. And nobody's going to ask that it's not good and we need to have, but also a lot of bad. So we are going to have a different podcast on that, Thomas. This is too interesting. But still on the AI, but for the master, how is your feeling about students being able now more than ever to use ChatGPT and other AI tools? They can create the full research on using ChatGPT. We were talking to the teachers the other day. They can... write their learning logs using ChatGPT, and then they have problems explaining what was the idea behind their prompt. So I wanted, as an expert in AI, what is your point of view about the using the academic scenery?
Yes. Within the masters, we allow AI to be used for everything. And we do that a little bit as an experiment as well, to see how far do people push it. What we're noticing is that the quality of writing has tremendously improved. But what the interesting thing here is as well, is that we get from students is like, no, I only use it in the last steps because I recognize that I need to learn how to express my thoughts properly in writing, and that I then do more editing afterwards to enhance the writing is my goal. Now, that does require a little bit more of a mature student. I recognize that if you're dealing with very young students, this is a different context. But on a master's level, what we are noticing right now is that people want to learn how to use these tools, but they also recognize the importance of the traditional, I need to know how to do it first before I start automating things. Now, that's a level of insight I'm personally very happy with, because it accelerates their writing process. If anything, I would like them to spend less time on writing, and especially on the technical formatting end, and more on the how good is this idea in the first place. Now, I've had this debate with quite a few lecturers that teach academic writing, and their counter argument typically is writing is a form of thinking on its own. In the same way that we used to write game design documents, which forced game designers to truly think about the mechanics that they were working with, by writing it down, you are forced to really detail exactly how something is going to work. Now, the same is true for academic writing. When you write a paper, when you're fleshing out an idea like this, that writing process is essential to good in-depth critical thinking. And as long as students are aware of this and you explain this to them, they see, oh, right, I should do this by hand first and then automate it. The danger lies in education specifically if you just say, oh, you're allowed to do whatever. Don't think about it, just do. But that's the death to any good education, in my opinion.
And we have one more question, then we have to close, and I have two. But what is your advice in relation of should we, as education, be teaching people how to better use AI in academic feature, how to create the best prompts, how to really, the same way that we teach people how to research, right? It's not everybody knows how to research in the first place. Mm-hmm. Is it is this the responsibility of education to teach how people to use AI in an ethical way?
Yes, I do think that that is a responsibility for good educators to consider in any domain, not just games. That's a broader implementation everywhere, because AI is going to touch almost every single field. You're going to run into AI tools in the future, no matter what domain you're in. You're going to need to know how these systems work. And I mean that on a proficiency level of being able to use them, right? In the same way that not everyone that drives a car understands exactly how a car works, but they're able to drive a car.
Yep.
For the vast majority of people,
or to change a tire. Yeah.
For example, but the vast majority of people can use a car effectively. The vast majority of people will need to be able to use AI tools effectively. Not everyone needs to be able to develop these tools. However, in our domain, in games, I do think we should be teaching the majority of our developers how to build their own tools. Because that's where one of the main strengths of AI lies, is in the customization of the tool set that you're working with to build your own tools effectively.
Yeah. And my last question is, can you give an advice for the people that heard this podcast and went, yes, I want to do the master's. I want to be part of it. I want to be having these amazing discussions with intelligent people. What is your advice to them?
First of all, we have a wonderful website that lists all the dates for all the things that I'm being put on the spot on to remember from the top of my head. However, we have an incoming webinar in 2 weeks from now where I will detail all the exact requirements, steps, and content of the master's in more depth. And additionally, we will have an open evening if you are able to attend in the coming months. So definitely check out the website buos.nl and figure out if you are able to attend, because we have a lovely campus that I would highly encourage you to visit to see what kind of environment we're dealing with when it comes to high-class education.
And because this podcast is pre-recorded, might be that when you see it, you already lost all these dates. Still go to buos.nl and see there are more dates there. We are open until May for people to come in. So if you miss those dates, don't get discouraged. There are other opportunities. Just check this website. Thomas, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Absolutely my pleasure.
See you guys next week. And then it went like...